Hello, James.
What you are about to hear is an experiment in internet radio that is so potentially divisive, so dangerous, that it could only appear at Majority Rights Radio, where, as you probably know, high culture meets high technology at the bleeding edge of the radical right. Yeah, we have something extra
especially fun with the listeners now.
High culture meets high technology at the bleeding edge of the radical right. Majority Rights Radio.
Hello.
For the listeners, a conference call with you and guest worker if he picks up.
Okay.
Are you there, David?
Yes, guest I'm worker. There. Who am I speaking to?
This is Soren Renner and James Bowery.
Oh, James. Hello, James. Okay.
Can you be a little louder, guest worker?
Can I be a little louder?
Yes.
Oh, I hope you're not recording this.
Oh, absolutely, we're recording this.
Well, you'll have to start again because I'm not ready for this. I'm looking instead for how the hell I get this louder.
What?
How do I increase the volume?
Well, I think we have a time for a short joke here while guest worker gets his settings ironed out. All right, go ahead.
It was great. So a ventriloquist is doing the circuit in the Midwest.
Yeah.
And he's in this small town and club in Kentucky, and he is rattling off all these really dumb, you know, blonde jokes. And all of a sudden, you know, somebody halfway back, you know, this blonde like stands up and says, you know, hey, how can you stand up there and say all these dumb blonde jokes? You're objectifying women, and you're ruining my reputation as a person and in the workplace and the community, and everything is just, you know, totally false, and you should really be ashamed of yourself, and, you know, I have dignity. And he's like, you know, and the guy is like, listen, I feel really bad, you know, I'm sorry. And before he can like spit out his apology, she goes, you stay out of this, you know, I'm talking to that little bastard on your knee.
And now, back to our previously scheduled program, which was already in progress. Just to remind you, guest worker has been fiddling with his settings.
I'll clean it up in post-production. Of course, the problem is that everybody's voice is sort of together on the recording. Well, I assume that...
I'm just looking at options, so hang on a second. Sound devices. There must be a volume.
Well, you're almost... Well, try talking a bit louder, moving the microphone.
I can't talk loud. I haven't got a loud voice. I've got a soft, funny voice, you know? It's just one of those things.
Well, at least your voice isn't reedy and womanish like mine.
No, you're a reedy, womanish voice. It's true. I've got a very masculine voice.
Hey, let's make fun of Bowery's voice. Hello, James, say something.
Hi there, how's it going? Testing 1, 2, 3.
That's a man's voice.
See, it's a perfect radio voice.
That's why he's a married man, I suppose.
Right.
As we all are. I'm just looking.
James, try to talk less loudly so that you don't overpower us with your masculinity.
Yeah, that's right.
I don't know that I have a volume adjustment on this thing.
Well, you can speak more softly.
What are you using, James?
Perfect.
What are you using?
We're on a physical phone line with him because because I kept getting this echo. Sound familiar?
Yeah, sure.
So let me bring you up to speed, guest worker. We were just discussing honeybees and colony collapse disorder. Most of the honeybee colonies in the United States are turning up dead or missing.
Oh, wow.
All of a sudden, and it's some sort of ecologically constrained death serum virus thing. And if it starts affecting high schools as well as beehives, then we're really in trouble.
Well, yes, this is true, but I don't think that there's a great deal of overlap between the two. Principally, worker bees are born to work their balls off, when, as we know perfectly well, everybody goes to high school to get laid. So there's a fundamental difference, and I'm fairly certain that...
First of all, it's the females that work.
One isn't necessarily deadly to the other. Sorry?
It's the females that work. James?
Hi there.
Yeah. So, this is merely an experiment. And I can't actually guarantee that this is going to hit the internet airwaves.
I hope to God it doesn't, because this is all a load of rubbish.
Right.
Anybody who pays good money to listen to this would be nuts. Well, they don't pay, but I mean, you know what I mean. No, I think
we're paying time.
If you're going to do this, you're going to have to plan it. You're going to have to let me know, and we're going to have to decide exactly what we're going to talk about. And it'll have to be something that we can all reasonably be expected to contribute fruitfully on.
Why don't you just jump in then? James, I want to repeat again, try to talk more quietly so that it all works together. Because
I can try moving the microphone away from my mouth. How's this?
That's much better.
Okay.
We were just talking about autism. Are you familiar with this guest worker?
No.
This is where a young lad, instead of learning how to...
I know what autism is.
They make rude noises, they flap their hands, and...
In what context do you... Are you talking about it? What is the actual route into areas of interest?
Haven't you been reading James's posts?
I do, and I don't. Because I find James's posts are often so creative, they leap off into areas where I have absolutely no expertise. His degree of creativity for an engineer is astonishing. And I wish I could emulate it. I actually was thinking this morning, I've got to try to be more of an original thinker, rather than just a sort of third-rate tinfoil hat commenter, you know?
You know, I've got to be more of an original thinker. You know, that thought has absolutely been done to death.
Really?
Oh, absolutely.
There James? Is no hope.
Yeah.
Any comments?
No.
About original thinking?
Yes.
Well,
you
I don't
do
know,
it every
I guess.
Day.
I guess.
Yeah, are you aware that...
One of the things about being... What's that?
Are you aware that you think entirely originally? Are you aware of that?
Well, I endeavor to do... So. What I really endeavor to do is just sort of try to be radical, get to the root of things, and sort of that requires a degree of creativity, I think.
Yes, so your aim isn't to be original, which has surely been done to death, but to use originality.
Be ruthless about the truth.
Right.
being ruthless right. about the truth is something that results in all kinds of... Well, I think that may be a definition of creativity in a sense. Looking at just the discoveries about the scientific method and its relationship to information theory, as I've been doing, one of the key things is being able to reify concepts anew that better or that make the description of the world more parsimonious, and that appears to be fundamental. So
James,
have you read
Eysenck's book?
Eysenck, no.
Eysenck, Hans Eysenck, he London School of Psychology, you know, he taught Jensen and all those people. He wrote a book toward the end of his life in the early 90s, Genius, The Natural History of Creativity, which is an extraordinarily good book. You're not familiar with it?
And what did you draw from that?
Well, if we ever manage to get an interview with Chris Brand, you'll hear more about this than, believe me, that you want to.
Well, I'm asking now. I mean, let's not wait for the interview with Chris Brown.
Genius is not simply high IQ. If it were, we'd be overrun with geniuses.
Yes.
Because there are lots of very clever people.
Yes.
It involves a combination of high IQ, often somewhat unfortunate early history, and psychoticism. Basically, have you known artists, people like this? They're generally a bit cold. They're not the friendliest people, right?
Right.
They're often
quite interesting people, but
right.
And I think leftist politicians, or not politicians particularly, but leftist intellectuals are often very similar in that they are when you meet them, they're often quite weird people. Quite alarming, really, that they seem to go through life without any actual experience or knowledge of anything, but they have many theories about it all.
That's not the same as genius. But the point is, genius is associated with...
The desire to explain is the same, though, is it not?
No.
Genius. I don't mean genius in terms of. Of
well, let's ask James Bowery what he thinks about genius. He should know.
Well, genius. Well, I can talk about intelligence and applied intelligence. You know, so I guess you know, intelligence is the ability to more parsimoniously model the world, and applied intelligence is the ability to get the greatest expected value from that model. So, you know, creativity, I think, occurs mainly at the level of intelligence. And
actually, you know, they're uncorked. Insofar as creativity can be measured with psychometric instruments, it isn't correlated with G at all above 120 IQ. They're orthogonal as far as we can tell. However, now, and this is interesting, we don't know if they're correlated below 120 IQ. And that's because it's really not possible to measure creativity below 120 IQ.
There are other problems. I mean,
so IQ is high IQ is necessary for creative work that results in new discoveries that other people end up adopting, and because, of course, the only way to study genius is to study people who are famous and recognized for being geniuses eventually, not necessarily in their lifetime. And one thing we know is that, you know, very, very many high IQ people who are very rigid and completely uncreative. But high IQ is necessary. It's a necessary precondition of doing interesting work that ends up being recognized.
Yeah, I guess there's a question, sort of a behavioral question, which is, if you've got a rock that's the most intelligent object in the universe and it just sits there, like, you know, does that really mean it's intelligent? I mean, you know, giving an intelligence test is pretty different from somebody walking around the world and actually sort of conceptualizing and coming up with ways of viewing it. And then there's also the applied intelligence angle, which is, you know, where you get technology from.
And okay, I just thought of a great idea. James, would you go on hold just for like 30 seconds so you can't hear me? So I can ask David a question, but you can't hear, okay? And then I'm going to ask you
the same question. Oh,
yeah.
Okay. Well, let's see if I can put this thing on hold. Just a second.
All right. Okay, can you hear me, James?
Okay, I've got a button that says hold. I'm going to press it now.
Okay. Guest worker?
Yes.
I want you to think of a use for a brick that nobody else would be likely to think of. A simple brick. You have it in your hands. How would you use a brick in a creative way that nobody else would think of?
Oh, this is awful.
Quick,
unfair.
Very quickly.
Whoever said I was creative?
Very quickly.
Oh, goodness
when
me.
It comes
well, use for a brick. Use for a brick.
10 seconds.
I'm in trouble. Everything I'm thinking of has already been done. I've had cars
on
in my time.
All right. David was guest worker was unable to answer the question.
Yeah.
James, now we'll ask you. In 15 seconds, can you think of a new use for a brick that no one else would think of?
A new use for a brick that no one else would think of.
Right.
Well, I don't know. Maybe we could, you know, set it up as an icon for a religion that you know, worships some sect of masonry or something. I don't know.
That's actually a pun. I like that very much. Now,
okay.
You see, David, do you see?
Yeah, but is that creative?
Yes.
Yeah, I don't know. what are you doing, Soren?
The three definitions.
Well,
I
just realized
of creative.
Well, of course, I have a more creative idea for using a brick, but I can't demonstrate it. You know, I had it already, so it would be invalid of me to oppose it to your,
right,
frankly, very clever idea. However, okay. I'll tell you what anyway.
Let me go a little bit.
I actually know the most creative use for a brick possible.
What's that?
Do you know those Russian dolls?
You won't get a brick inside one of them.
No. Okay, a series of ceramic brick-shaped Russian dolls.
But you're cheating.
And then the
you
brick, you actually paint a little babushka face on the brick and use it as the innermost in a
of
set
straw.
of Russian of ceramic Russian dolls.
Okay, all right, I'll give you that. Can I try to broaden out a little bit what creative actually means? Because I think that we've got a... Oh, hell, I've got a Skype call coming in on another computer. How annoying.
Well, that's fine. Here, come back in a few minutes. Just stay online.
That's okay.
Come back.
That's okay. That's all right. Carry on.
James?
I'm here.
Did you think of anything else to do with the brick?
No, I didn't realize that was the task before me.
Well, could we combine our ideas? I mean, there's no reason you couldn't worship the little... You know, it could be inside the Russian dolls, and you could still worship it. These are ceramic dolls, right?
Can I make a serious discussion?
What?
Gentlemen, yes? Please. Is it possible to have a serious discussion about creativity? Rather than this nonsense. I mean, let's try... it seems to me that there are two or three different ways of looking at it. If you're taking something which... pre-exists, if you're working in an environment, for instance, in which you are researching something, highly technical perhaps, there's a kind of developmental creativity involved. It is a developmental process. You're not actually creating from dust in that process, but what you're doing is like a mushroom cloud rising up after an explosion. You're not creating the explosion, you're furthering the rise of the cloud. That's one form of creativity, and that's the type of creativity that most people follow these days. The actual explosion is the more important one and the rarest kind, and I would have thought that that did have a pretty clear input to IQ. There is a third type of creativity, which is sort of Eastern mystical type, you might be able to get it that way, which is the self-creativity, and that's probably the most important of the three, and would not, to my mind, be particularly linked to IQ. Okay, I finished. I mean,
I think you don't understand what ISANC means by creativity that can be studied as a contract.
These are how I understand.
This is a very simple idea. You have a test where you ask people to come up with ideas, you know, like word combinations or uses for things. And what we mean by a very creative person is a person who, whatever you ask them, they will be able to come up with answers that other people don't come up with, or very rare responses.
That's not necessarily creativity, then.
But that's what's actually meant by creativity as a construct
that
can be measured.
If you have a belief in human purpose, a sort of Jungian belief, like individuation or something of that sort, that's also creativity. But it's nothing to do with the kind of very narrow ideas-based creativity that you're talking about.
It's not just ideas.
Here's the thing.
Most people are incapable of coming up with new content. Most people can't make up new jokes. The ordinary run of the people can't come up with the new technical solutions, new origami folds. James, you know what I'm talking about. Whereas I guarantee you that with Mr. Bowery, for instance, you could hand him any set of materials, any question in any field of human endeavor, and he would be able to say something which had not been said before, simply effortlessly.
That's not creativity, though, Soren. Creativity is being able to actually. I mean, it's like necessity is the mother of invention.
Wait a sec. But it is the raw material for creativity.
Okay,
to say, you're right. There is the step also where we select. Well, you're talking about the actual work of genius, creative work. It involves selection from material.
It involves critique.
And critique, right. But in order to have anything to select from, you've got to be able to come up, you have to be able to have new stuff to winnow. And the point is that someone like our hyper-creative Mr. Bowery, just on the basis of this brick test, is whatever he sets his mind to, whatever he looks at, he will be able to come up with new ideas to select from and to critique. And that is what is simply beyond the reach of So all uncreative means is that you're fairly highly constrained by the past, by expectation. You're able to do things in the way that they've been done before. And in fact, there are handicaps associated with being creative. But Mr. Bowery, would you like to tell us about those?
There are handicaps about being creative?
Well, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean,
for instance, it's difficult to act like an uncreative normal person, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you're genuinely creative, then they generally don't have much of a social milieu with which you can identify, because everybody, you know, social milieus tend to have a set of norms that you have to be willing to violate to be creative. Now, there are cultures, and I think European culture is one of them, that actually value individual creativity, and this is one of the things I think, you know, we've had arguments and discussions about this before on MR, but I really think that this is really key to understanding the difficulties that Europeans are having, and that is we are by nature, I believe, individualistic, and it's one of our greatest values. It's one of the things that makes us most valuable and most creative. And protecting that...
Yes?
I'm sorry? Yeah, I mean, protecting that individualism, which I believe is genetically endowed by our ancestors and possibly consciously endowed by eugenic practices of our ancestors, but protecting that in the present environment where we are flooded by peoples who are not individualistic is the great paradoxical challenge facing Europeans.
Wait. I have to follow up on that, because that is, you just said something fascinating. You think there may have been eugenics, conscious eugenics in the past?
Yes.
Please.
I think anybody who denies that is got their head in the sand. I mean, basically, you know, it's obvious simply from the existence of slave societies that was going on with respect to slaves. But if you go back further and look at the dawn of agriculture and people engaging in all kinds of relationships with nature, it would have taken an idiot not to apply those same principles of animal husbandry, et cetera, to humans.
But Plato complained that nobody was doing that, that in fact people were careless of, they were careful of the breed of their horses, and they were marrying their daughters off to anybody with the bucks.
That's what happens in civilization. Okay, I think civilizations cause that. And it's
right.
I think it's because of parasites.
Okay, keep talking.
Well, I mean, you know, when you have a bunch of populations that are relatively in a natural state, and so there isn't a huge flux or huge flow of organic materials around, it's more or less a natural flow of organic materials, including humans.
You say parasites, you don't, let's make it clear to all the listeners, you don't mean just, it's not just a code word for the Jews, right? In this case, you're not talking about the Jews at all.
Well, no, I'm not. I use parasites in a very broad sense as these you know, systems, be they genetic or mimetic or some combination thereof, that replicate by going into areas that can support them and then maybe decimating them and moving on. I'm talking about, you know, parasites that are not very well co-evolved with their hosts. And I think that where Jews got a serious problem was when they went into diaspora, basically became mobile, and that creates an evolutionary incentive to exploit and move on. And, you know, if you deal with that over a long enough period of time, it gets pretty ingrained. So, from that perspective, yeah, I am, you know, talking in terms of, like, the found, like, the Persian Empire and stuff like that. There are some things. But even further back than that, yeah, I think that there are, you know, you get parasites that start to exploit population centers that, you know, have a lot of traffic and trade and things of that nature. And as a result of that, I think that it causes people to, their cognitive functions to fail.
Do you mean by parasites essentially Soltus freeloaders?
Or are you going he's talking about things like smallpox. For instance, smallpox
couldn't Yeah, okay.
Smallpox needs a very large population to burn through in humans. So if
you're talking about, Soren, about aspects of humanity, which would lead to the development of individualized Westerners here, and the Western fascination with individualization. And the question then arises, how did that come about? Well, if you're claiming that there's some other agency than simple sort of Rushdonian evolutionary psychology involved in that, then lay it out and make it clear.
Well, I would like to just say just a single paragraph here, just as background. And this is from Wikipedia. Parasitism is one version of symbiosis, living together, a phenomenon in which two organisms which are phylogenetically unrelated coexist over a prolonged period of time, usually the lifetime of one of the individuals. The requirement for a prolonged interaction precludes predatory or episodic interactions such as a mosquito feeding on a host, which are usually not seen as symbiotic relationships. Symbiosis encompasses commensalism, eating at the same table, mutualism, both species benefit, to parasitism, wherein one organism, usually physically smaller of the two, the parasite, benefits, and the other, the host, is harmed. Especially in the field of medical parasitology, the term parasite has come to mean a eukaryotic, pathogenic organism. Thus, protozoan and metazoan infectious agents are classified as parasites, while bacteria and viruses are not. Interestingly, fungi are not discussed in textbooks of medical parasitology, even though they are eukaryotic. So I was incorrect when I brought up smallpox. That's being a virus, that's technically not a parasite. Although, would you use that, James, or would you call those parasites too?
Well, there's a point where some of the distinctions have become rather pedantic. I think that it's more reasonable to talk about any kind of creature that replicates at the expense of some other creature or system of creatures as being parasitic, and I don't see how you can exclude smallpox or microbes in general.
You know, there's a point I've been wanting to make for a while, for probably months, which is that a lot of the talk about parasitism in our community of interest, of discussion, or all of the talk of parasitism, elides this question of coevolution. Because some of the parasites we talk about clearly did coevolve with us. And some of the uses of the concept of parasitism don't involve anything like coevolution and don't involve selection, but involve other mechanisms. I'm particularly thinking of, if one was to say, and Kevin MacDonald wouldn't say this, but if one was to talk about the Jews as living parasitically on the peoples of the West, what's clear, absolutely clear, is that this was not this tendency. I'm not denying that they might be evolved to be good at it, even biologically evolved, not just socially evolved. But this can't have been selected for biologically. In other words, if there was selection involved, it was cultural selection impinging on biology. So,
well,
I simply
don't agree with that, Soren. I think that I don't see how you can say. I mean, I'll put it like this, okay? If you've got a mobile system, a system that can go from one habitat to another habitat to another habitat, okay?
Right.
The evolutionary incentive is there to be pathogenic and feed off of the systems that you're moving through. I mean, that's true regardless of whether you're talking about culture or genes.
Okay.
And the thing that makes it so that you aren't virulent is what's called vertical transmission. Okay, vertical transmission. I mean, what I just talked about with this mobility is horizontal transmission in evolutionary medicine. Vertical transmission means basically you sleep in the bed that you made.
Right.
And it may take a while, but eventually either the system of which you are a part dies entirely, or some kind of mutualistic relationship develops that is at least less pathogenic than it would be under the horizontal transmission scenario.
Do you know about the dusky-footed wood rat of California?
No.
I read a fascinating book from the 1930s, 1940s at the downtown library in Chicago a few years ago. It was one of these big scientific studies, you know, like not a doctorate work, but like postgraduate work. Anyway, there are these things that are like muskrats, but they're related to muskrats, but they're wood rats. I think they're also related to pack rats. And they live in California. And they build, you know how muskrats build these enormous, like, hovels in the middle of marshes? Well, they do this, but sort of beneath the spreading oaks. But these are, like, big piles of brush.
They need some
on
brush.
Land in California. And the interesting, what this guy discovered by taking apart some of these piles, and so the thing lives and feeds, mostly lives, in this enormous ramshackle, like, pile of sticks that it's heaped up. I'm not sure how long these things are, 20 feet long, 50 feet long. But it moves its bedroom every few weeks. It changes where it sleeps in the pile. And apparently the explanation is that the ticks build up, the parasites build up in the bedroom. So when you said about sleeping in the bed that you've made, that's what I thought of. I thought of the dusky-footed wood rat of California.
Well, obviously. I suppose that's okay to think about that. I don't think that's really an application of the principle of horizontal versus vertical transmission, except in a very, you know, maybe roundabout way. I mean, eventually, if they did not, in that situation, it's not the parasite that's mobile, it's the host, and the host is trying to get away from the parasites. And yeah, that's part of the dynamic, but it's not the central point about the evolution of virulence or pathogenicity, if that's a word. The central point that I was trying to make, and we can get back, I think we should get back to the individualism of Europeans, is that
okay.
once you have civilization, you've got this tendency, this architectural tendency to provide the mobility that supports the evolution of virulence. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, any reasonable public health approach to civilization has to pay strict attention to the mobility of the replicating systems within it. And if it doesn't, then it's bad architecture.
Right, because, well, I'm not sure if this is related, but obviously, you know, the wearing blender effect is the enemy of biodiversity. You know, like tree snakes to Guam, bad idea. Brown rats, black rats everywhere, bad idea. Placental mammals to Australia, bad idea for biodiversity. Is that, I'm not sure that's related.
Well, yeah, it is related. And in fact, we talked about this earlier with respect to the bee problem, and I think that, you know, at least speculating about what's causing the failure of hives and also a lot of phenomena that otherwise inexplicable. I think it's like autism. I think it's reasonable to expect these things are ecological in nature.
Yeah, some of the problem with the beehives, there's this mite, that's the Varroa mite, that's been infecting beehives for like some years now. But apparently the mites, which are parasites, spread between hives, and they spread viruses. And I think this is, anyway, it was behind a lot of the earlier sort of colony die-offs that they were having in the last few years. I'm not sure about this latest one.
Right.
So you have different levels of parasites.
So I guess getting back to European, the paradoxical situation in which Europeans find themselves, I think that this goes back to, you know, the very early history of Europe, where maybe even the relationship to Neanderthals, where there was a very low population density. People were relatively independent of each other because of the low population density. They had to be relatively self-sufficient. They had to be creative about the way in which they related to their natural environment. because it was, from the standpoint of the human species, a new environment. And this resulted in a degree of creativity and individuality, et cetera. It also resulted in a degree of dependence on teaching from parents to children. So as a child, conformity is actually enormously important because you're getting a transmission, essentially, of a completion of your DNA in the form of culture. And
James, can I ask you a question at this point? I'd be interested to know your view of this, because it's something that's often puzzled me. But conformity, you mentioned, and it does strike me that other Northern Hemisphere populations with a high IQ are far more heavily centered on conformity than they are on individualism. And when you look at the East-West split between those two, there doesn't seem to be any particular reason why one population should tend so heavily, be selected so heavily for by environment for conformity, and the other so heavily towards individualization. I just wonder whether you had any view of that.
Well, he gave a clue to his ideas, right, when he mentioned the Neanderthals. I think that's a clue.
Yeah, I think that the European relationship with the Neanderthals is very important. I'm not really sure exactly how this is played out. Here's my speculation, broad speculation, is that something happened in Europe where, particularly around the time of the Neolithic, when agriculture started being introduced and population density started rising, I think that the people reacted in such a way to the higher population densities that and the introduction of agriculture in such a way that they actually consciously decided to institute cultural rules that would select and protect individuality. And I think this is a result of just simply having a good grasp of nature, including human nature, and the effect of agriculture on that and the interaction with that.
James, just on that question, do you see the spread of IQ in the West as being part of that, or a result of that? And do you see the sort of Chinese experience, particularly East Asian experience, of a more constrained and constricted spread, as having any sort of base in which you can actually say, well, yes, it happened from that reason. That was why they were conforming. I mean, you're giving us something on individualization. What about the other side of the coin? What can you say on that?
Well, yeah, I don't really understand entirely what the differences are between Europeans and, say, Northeast Asians, the Buryat, the Mongols, and on into the New World, the Northern American tribes. I think that there are some important relationships there and some important similarities there due to climatic selection and due to the fact that they were always pushing out to these sort of frontier areas away from existing populations. But I do think there is something particular or peculiar about Europeans that resulted in exceptional creativity in the presence of agriculture. In other words, there may have been some characteristics that were in the New World populations that were somewhat related to the European characteristics of being able to populate frontiers and individualism and creativity. But when agriculture shows up, it creates a selective pressure that is very different. And I think that one of the things that just for an example, one of the things that people have talked about with respect to Europeans is that the exceptional attractiveness of the European females is a result of sexual selection arising from high mortality rates among the males during the Paleolithic, and the fact that they weren't really able to support more than one female. In other words, for a female to have children, they had to have a male around, so there's a tremendous competition, which took the form of sexual selection. And when you get into the agricultural revolution, all of a sudden you have the capacity for a male to support more than one female potentially even. And this is a situation that could create a crisis, a biological crisis in the population. I think that one of the adaptations to that was single combat, formalized single combat between males. There are other places in the world where this arose just because this is something that males tend to do in other species, but I think that there were a few places that has had it as a sort of conscious law the way the especially the Northern Europeans did.
James?
Surely single combat is a little bit unrelated to sexual selection. I mean, the point about combat per se is that it is territorial. It is developed in order to defend one's territory because territory is a guarantor of group survival. And therefore it has a cooperative base and not
not this kind of combat.
Well,
James is suggesting...
Combat, yeah, I know, but single combat doesn't mean anything in itself. I think it's part of the kind of mindset, the competitive, aggressive mindset. I think that if you go
are
to...
Either you,
if,
James,
if you
are
go
you
to,
aware...
If you go to Africa, they'll have their societies will have exactly the same traditions of single combat.
Are you aware of evidence in the bones, not from Homo sapiens, but from older, like Homo erectus? There's evidence of selection for skull thickness hundreds of thousands of years ago. So for a long period of evolution, at least certain hominin species were hitting each other over the head with great regularity in the males. We know this because the skull was much thicker.
That could be true of both group warfare as well as single combat. And I understand that, you know, their single combat appears all over the place. But what I guess I'm saying about specifically about Europeans is I think that there may have been a formalization of it that didn't appear other places. And
there again,
a resistance.
Very formalized in the East as well. And probably the most one of the older systems of formalization of combat is in Japan.
And I think that there's a reason why Japanese culture is so appealing to European nationalists. I think that there is some relationship here. Now, this is not to say that they're identical in any, but I think that there's, especially if you go back to the Jomon and the earlier Japanese cultures. You know, I knew there's very clearly some identification with Europeans. I mean, at least in the minds of a lot of European nationalists.
Yeah, but Japan is also a very conformist society.
Well, yeah,
so,
and there's Japan has its own history.
You're slowly
there.
Tying yourself up in knots. If you're going to predicate something on a form of combat that exists in Japan, you have an immediate problem because you have this great drift amongst the population towards conformity. I mean, educationally, even today, children are really, really beaten to the point that they have their individual tendencies are driven out of them. That's a very clearly defined practice in Japanese education. It's always been so.
Yeah, the history of Japan has some characteristics about it that are very, I mean, you don't have a single population in Japan. You have different cultures that came in at different times. And the earlier culture is the one that, for example, was the origin of the samurai. And, yeah, that's been displaced.
Weren't a lot of them Ainu?
Ainu, yes.
Yes.
But I mean, just finishing up on the Japanese, they are fundamentally a very conformative people, as are the rest of the East Asians. And they also happen to have a high but narrow range of IQ.
I've heard that I've never seen any good evidence for it. I've never seen, for instance, Jensen saying that was true, or Isank.
Well, certainly,
is that really true, James?
James? Russians said it's true.
Well,
James?
I mean, the high
the
but
standard
narrow.
Deviation? Yeah, the idea is the standard deviation of IQ is less in Asian populations.
Well,
I've heard this asserted, but I've never seen.
Doug Griff has certainly got something up on his website about that, and it's
does
been,
he?
It's been produced on MR several times. Yeah.
Yeah, but that also applies in Europe. When you go by latitude, you get a lower standard deviation, and I think that one of the reasons.
Wait,
is
further north you go?
Or yeah, the further north
south you go.
It's not a real strong correlation, but it's there, and so you have a similar kind of pattern where I believe it has to do with heterozygosity. In other words, the more The more genetic uniformity you have, obviously, the more phenotypic uniformity you're going to have. And
this increases to the north.
Yeah, I think it decreases. I think it increases. The uniformity increases the more inbreeding you have. And so
this ties us into your genetic omnidominance hypothesis, which is actually a subject of another show. I want to say, you know, this has been so fascinating, gentlemen. We've used up a lot of the time we have. So I wondered if you would mind
not another brick.
Putting this stuff on the side and just talking about majority rights, the blog, the place, for a few minutes. Would that be all right?
Yep.
Sure.
Okay, so how about this partial frolic gentleman?
Potential.
And his what?
His potential.
Potential frolic.
I think he's fulfilling his potential, to be honest.
I've been
surprised by his... He's a very intelligent guy and obviously has some artistic talents, since we're talking about creativity, that I had never realized lurked at the beginning, but that's fine.
You mean the Homeric rap?
Yeah, that's... I've never been interested myself in rap. I'm a bit surprised to find that there are people... I guess he's a sort of 140 IQ type who really go in for too much in that department, and it's rather brave of him to admit that he did do. There we go. Yeah, he's a great addition, and more power to his elbow.
However, he seems to inspire these comments. Let's see. Andy Worcester comments, "If I never see another rap-related post, it will be too soon. This makes me long for the days of JJR." You know, personally, it offends me whenever people say that anything that happens on the blog is worse than a post by JJR. That offends me, because I don't think anything is worse than a post by JJR was.
You were amongst his true fans.
And I realize that, and I'm sure he'll welcome the opportunity at some point to be interviewed.
Do you think Partial Frolic would come on and actually...
Potential Frolic. He won't come on unless you get his name right.
Do you think he would actually do the spoken word version of his rap? Because I really can't feel the rhythm just looking at it.
You'll have to ask him. It seems to me to be something that requires a degree of...
reserve. But there again, I'm English.
We're calling PF out. PF, contact Majority Rights Radio, and we'll put you on the air, and we'll make you famous.
Yeah, I hope he is actually white after all this. There is the possibility, of course, that we've been well and truly screwed. But I don't think so. His early posts were certainly very good, and you did say yourself that we need more poetry. So I don't feel that you're in a position to...
Oh, we need a lot more poetry.
Okay.
Actually, perhaps, PF, perhaps we haven't winkled him out. We have to tempt him out.
Mm-hmm.
And the best way to get these verbal performance guys to put their heads up into the line of fire is to actually challenge them, make them jealous. So... in the interest of that, I wondered if one of you would ask me to rap.
No, I don't think so. Do you want to ask him that, James?
No, ask James?
Yeah.
Are you willing to ask me to rap? What?
If you insist.
Oh, dear.
But I don't.
Okay, well, no, I just wanted to comment on Potential Frolic or Pablo Face or whatever his name is today. You know, first of all, I don't consider it to be appropriate to change pseudonyms unless there's something that really requires, for security reasons. I mean, I understand people's needs to remain anonymous. I am one of the least anonymous people, and I support people remaining anonymous. But I think that it's important to remain pseudonymous and have a consistent identity that you adopt.
You don't want people just making up some sort of, like antipodean, ridiculous hijink pseudo-identity.
You mean
to double
well,
their own?
I think that the problem with doing that kind of stuff is that it just lends to people's public interactions.
Can you repeat that? You dropped out. I didn't hear that.
It
lends what?
Lends an environment of irresponsibility. And
I think it's more important than that. When people change their identities frequently, and there are reasons for doing it. I mean, there are sometimes.
I agree.
Situations where you know one and I know one, the same one, where a certain individual has been hounded somewhat and wants to be able to continue in contact with the blog and making useful contributions. And under those circumstances, it's clearly tolerable to everybody that he should continue under whatever guise he chooses. But there are other people who will move from one identity to another for mischievous reasons, and sometimes they don't really mean any ill through it, but other times they do. I think in the end the test is whether it's fair on the ordinary commenter and the ordinary reader, who has a right, I think, to know who he's talking to and to be able to relate it to this person's past record. And I would prefer, I don't want everybody, obviously I don't, but I don't want everybody to use their real name, but I would like everybody to use the same name where they reasonably can. I think it's courteous, amongst other things, and courtesy is important at MR, and is one of the, being civilized is one of the ways that we manage to cope with fairly incendiary ideas. And anything.
Let's get back to the rapping.
Oh, Soren, all right, please give us a rap.
Mutatis mutandis. It's like I plan this. I'm rhyming, like Simon, and I scan this. Is that the self-same Simon as in Simon Says? You know, Simone de Beauvoir was an existential les. Whenever she and Sartre would part, the kinky sex would start. She'd head straight from the cafe to a girls-only orgy, where one chick was the pie and the rest were Georgie Porgy. Damn, I should have said Jack Horner, but the rhythm and the rhyme scheme had me backed into a corner like a sickly purple puddle at the bottom of our time. I cause you nausea, and that's why I wrote this rhyme. Just as a racing rider on his racing motorbike cannot be overtaken by a toddler on a trike, you can't catch up to me because you're not a polymath. You're just cross, not super cross, like Jeremy McGrath. Maybe you thought that you could learn it from a book. If Mad Skills for Dummies was really all it took, then we would be analogous, and you and I could trade. If I were game and you weren't lame and you were not afraid, but still I think the results would probably be outlandish if I were you and you were me, mutatis mutandis. That's Latin for the necessary changes being made.
Well, I'll give you a few rounds of applause for that one. It's excellent. But I don't really know that I could take it all in at that speed. I'd need to see it on the printed page. When are you going to put it up?
Or put it up, you might want to listen to it.
Put it up on PF's thread so that we can actually sit down and read.
Well, how about if I edit it into this excellent internet podcast radio show and you listen to it over and over again, flushing like a schoolgirl?
But I'm not a schoolgirl. Rap music is about the last thing I'd flush over if I was.
Well, that's not really rap. I mean, it's spoken
it's
word.
It's high-class rap, isn't it? I mean, you know, you didn't actually shoot anybody. But,
Well, I'll tell you something I want to talk
that,
about.
That they can prove.
What I want to talk about is the fact that Pobble Face or Potential Frolic, or I was talking about, you know, accuses me of being a pseudoscientist and that science has a certain quality about it that, you know, needs to be respected. To which I responded, well, MR is not really a scientific journal. If you would like to set something like that up, you know, let's talk about setting up an appropriate peer review system where, you know, people aren't changing identities. The reviewer comments are available to the public, so people can see exactly what is being suppressed and how and why it's being suppressed from the editorialized view of things. And, you know, let's just get on with it. And if that means that guys like me who are a bit too creative in an unconstrained or maybe even irresponsible way need to be excluded, then that's fine. But let's set up the process so that guys like you have your, you know, whatever is required. And I'm perfectly happy to sit by and watch you guys do the scientific thing.
Is he actually a famous scientist himself?
I think that his desire to have something, you know, there's a niche that needs to be filled that MR was at one point filling and it's no longer filling. And, you know, certainly if I am detracting from that, I would more than support guest worker in excluding me from posting to that particular blog, or in setting up something alternative to it. So, you know, I think that, you know, the desire to have sort of a referee, because we are suffering from corruption of the scientific community right now, and there are some areas where it's being corrected, but, you know, there's a very serious need for some free scientific inquiry that's you know, being suppressed. So, you know, if this is the kind of thing that's needed, then let's by all means get on with it, and I support PF's desire to achieve that. I have my opinions about his agenda, but that's okay if, you know, the process is open and set up in such a way that, you know, everybody sees the process.
James,
was this the same as your opinion of my possible agenda at the beginning?
No, you have a different agenda from PF. But, you know, I'm just trying to say that, you know, there is a role, there's a potential role here. And maybe I'm working on one angle of this, which is some kind of a wiki that may, in some partial sense, fulfill some of this. But
wait, does this have anything to do, guest worker? You told me there was some kind of Twinkie wiki thingy that some people that we might mention.
Yeah, at some point. But that's just.
Does James know about that?
That's a moot idea. James knows about that. Whether it's going to come to fruition, we don't know.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's some stuff that I'm sort of working on, and it may come to fruition or not. But I'm just saying, you know, that I may be able to make a contribution toward this kind of peer review thing, but it's not. It'd be in that sense rather than in the formal scientific journal, online journal sense. And there are people who are far better, you know, are clearly, you know, qualified to do that, and I'm not. But I would rather insist on seeing
the
reviewer's comments.
The point is, James, that as we've already discovered, is in kicking off original ideas, in critiquing what's around or picking things up and finding something in it that gives you a new point of departure, and that's something which is a process apart, and some considerable distance from the kind of serious science that goes into peer review journals. So I don't think there's any particular reason for MR or any other blog, GNXP, whatever, to attempt to raise itself to that very high peer review standard on science. I think that what blogs are for is to provide a medium where people with talent can come and bring their thinking and perhaps find that it's well received, perhaps find that it's critiqued in a constructive way, or perhaps find that it's ignored. But anyway, they can come and they can do it. I'm very happy to see as much scientific content as possible on the blog. We did at one point, of course, have JW posting regularly. JR, who's still heavily involved in I believe, with us, but a rare poster, if you can combine those two things. We'd like to have much more from these guys, but such it is. As more scientific people come on stream and say, look, you know, I could do this, or would you like to put that up, that'd be fine. And if they're only offering us some fairly new thinking, then that too is fine. We take essentially what we can get, and we're here to give them what we can. And if the one hand washes the other, then that's, by me, that's fine, that's okay, and we're fulfilling our function as regards to the reader.
All right, penultimate thought, right? I've got two things. And the first one is that when I interviewed Norman Lowell, he had a little comment, almost a throwaway comment. I didn't think much of it at the time, but I later heard an echo of it in a recorded talk by Pierce. And I realized that Lowell had gotten this thought from Pierce, and that it was an important thought. And what Lowell said was, you know, even here on Malta, which is a small place, there are, I know, men who would be better leaders of the radical right than me, but they're, you know, they're doing their martial arts or their spirituality or their painting or whatever, and they're not interested. We were discussing the sort of the Evolian apolitia. And then in this Pierce talk that I heard yesterday, the day before, at Stormfront, just on the radio, it was Pierce was saying, there are men more able than me, but they haven't stood up yet. Mm-hmm. But they can hear me, and they'll stand up. Mm-hmm. And I realized that Lowell had heard this thought, I'm sure, from Pierce.
I don't think it's his thought, because I think everybody who's involved with this knows this. And you and I have talked about this. And
but so the point
is,
this is our disagreement, you and I, because you think of majority rights as having an audience of the ordinary people who read it and find it interesting and comment, and those are the people we're trying to reach. And I think those people are not actually what MR is even for. Although I think
1.6 million hits a month. Now that's
okay. Well,
that's not bad. And amongst the people who come, there will be people from all sections. There's no question of that.
Well, obviously, the broader success is necessary, but the hits that we're looking for, the people we're actually trying to reach, are very few. I agree that the larger success is necessary in order for us to reach those few.
Yes.
I actually do agree on that.
At least because when you start getting the kind of coverage that we are beginning to get, then it will attract more PFs. More people are going to come to us, and they're going to say, okay, this is useful. I think I'd like to contribute. And that's building it all the time. You're going to have to start this movement from the bottom up. Politically, it has to be done from the bottom up. The BNP have realized that they've got to do this at the level of the council seats. They've got to build a structure. And it's the same in every area. We have to actually begin at the bottom. You can't begin... In my opinion, realistically, I think we're far too cynical for this. You can't begin with some great man who arrives and stirs everybody's hearts like.
You know, the elite is not small. The elite is not so very small.
Well,
but they're hiding.
The existing,
they're cryptic.
Yes, the existing.
There is a huge amount of talent out there.
Of course it is, but the existing potential is very small, because you're talking about people who are. Really thinking outside of the current zeitgeist, and they, as far as I can see, there aren't many of them. If you look at somebody like, intellectually speaking, if you look at somebody like Scruton, Roger Scruton, that guy is only just beginning to wake up, but he's been around the fringe of what you might call conservative philosophy, if there is such an animal, all his life. He's only now just beginning. Last year he gave a speech at VB which showed a little more consciousness of the situation.
Well, you've got to take whatever you did to Jeff back and bottle it.
Well, Jeff was ready.
Whatever you gave him to drink, you've got to...
I said to you when I had my interview, the core, the very, very heart of it all, is somebody must develop, and this is a totally individual thing, they must develop a question. They have to have this simple, aching question inside that won't leave them alone. It keeps kicking them every time they fall asleep. They're not comfortable. When they turn the television on, they get kicked all the time. This damn question eats away at them, and they eventually start saying, well, I can't find anything here that is going to give me a light on things. Maybe over here. And they start to search. All we can do, my whole point about setting up a blog like MR and the original thinking that's required in it, all we can do is to try to be a light that people recognize, because they can taste a kind of solution that nothing else gives.
I think we should be pushing KMAC harder. I honestly do. CFC is such a good book, and the thing is that you need to know something about the intellectual history of the 20th century. You need to know quite a bit about it before that book is going to make total sense to you.
Well, that's a long way down the line for guys who are not yet developing in their own hearts the kind of question I'm talking about. These elite guys at the moment, they're not there that I can see who are really, really trying to answer this question. They're still thinking along pretty conventional lines. They're not really the kind of original thinker like James.
Okay, final question. James.
Yeah.
Guest worker. I'm thinking of a person who I have talked about with you and with you, and I'm wondering if we should do an interview with him and then maybe have a conference call with him after that, if that works out. Now, do you think that's a good idea or a bad idea? Obviously, I'm not going to say who I'm talking about. Obviously, you know who I am talking about.
I wouldn't say it's obviously who you're talking about.
I do know who you're talking about, but will he come?
I imagine.
Do you know that?
I'm going to say, I don't know that, but I know that he'll talk to me. And he's not shy. So if he'll talk to me, he'll probably be agreed to be interviewed and recorded. I know that he will talk to me. Oh, well. Guest worker hung up on me. James,
yes,
you still there?
I'm here. Things just dropped out at this end as well.
Well, that's all for this week. Do tune in next week, same majority time, same majority station, for another exciting, thrilling edition of the serial adventure, Majority Rights Radio.